Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 392. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 459 on the Soviet Project 24 design battleships, the Wednesday video on Schnellboot, the German torpedo speedboats, and the Friday video on Yamato, the Final Letters, the graphic novel project. Redosaurus asks, since you often talk about ships from sci-fi franchises, I'm curious, how would you classify the Defiant from Star Trek Deep Space Nine? The Defiant is a little bit of a weird one. I don't think it fits fully into any particular classification because, obviously, within the lore of the Star Trek universe, she's designed as a true warship, which Starfleet doesn't really do at that point. She's designed to counter the Borg. And in various games and stuff, she's also described as a convoy escort and so forth. But in DS9, she's described as a legacy of an anti-Borg project. She's small, she's fast, she's very heavily armed, but she's also very heavily armored or protected. And, you know, at times, some people make allusions to the fact that she might have a similar level of firepower, give or take a little bit, to a galaxy class and so forth. Now, most of the characteristics she exhibits, so small, fast, maneuverable, capable of hitting big ships very, very hard, and actually, relatively speaking, short range, both in terms of the accommodation and her power plant, would tend to point towards her being a kind of a torpedo boat or a destroyer, that kind of fast attack craft, because they're small, fast, agile. They've got torpedoes, which makes them very heavily armed, capable of hitting and damaging ships far above their weight classification. And relatively speaking, short range, but that runs into the fact that the Defiant, as we said, is very heavily protected. She actually has armor, which most Starfleet ships don't. And of course, the firepower, overall firepower disparity, is quite a lot more significant than a torpedo boat it has compared to a battleship in real life. Now, some of that could be explained by the fact, as we said, that she is Starfleet's kind of first true warship of that time. And so if Starfleet was building its other ships as true warships, then you could argue they also would have ablative armor and perhaps in considerably greater quantities than the Defiant did. So which this is why it makes the comparison a little bit difficult. And you could also make the argument that a certain amount of the Defiant's capabilities come from the fact that she's equipped with the latest and greatest in Starfleet weapons technology, like quantum torpedoes, perhaps a little bit more so than just sheer levels of firepower. So, of course, a galaxy class doesn't have quantum torpedoes. But then you see in, I forget the name of the episode, but the episode where Admiral Layton, having transferred over from Babylon 5, decides he's going to try and take over Earth, and Defiant ends up fighting the Lakota, which is an Excelsior class, much, much older vessel, and the Excelsior's almost second-line ships by this point, but the Lakota has been upgraded with similar levels of technology to the Defiant, so modern phasers, presumably modern shields, and quantum torpedoes. Now, although both sides do hold off somewhat in attempting to destroy each other, it is kind of a knockdown, drag-out fight that ends up being a score draw, with both sides theoretically capable of finishing the other off if they'd use their quantum torpedoes, which, you know, timeline-wise is the equivalent of a late-period protected cruiser that's been heavily upgraded with modern weapons and fire control, standing off in a reasonable fight where neither side's actually actively trying to torpedo each other with a late World War II period destroyer like a Gearing, which actually, when you look at tonnage, displacement, and potential armament, is actually not that implausible. So in terms of, yeah, would they kind of fight each other to a draw? Yes, actually, pretty much. The Gearing, of course, would have a speed advantage, but if neither side is actively torpedoing each other, a protected cruiser that's been given half a dozen to a dozen 5-inch 38s or 4.5-inch would actually be a reasonably decent match with, again, similar levels of fire control. And so you could argue, well, if you upgraded a galaxy class, I mean, I don't necessarily think the galaxy class phasers need a huge amount of upgrades, but if you gave the galaxy class quantum torpedoes and updated shields, it would be more than a match for a Defiant. Obviously, the Sovereign class, dimensionally slightly longer, but overall a smaller vessel than the Galaxy class, which does have the latest in phasers and quantum torpedoes as well as photon torpedoes, plus shielding, etc. And I think the Sovereign does have a degree of armoring as well. And the Sovereign is very clearly, obviously, a massive overmatch for a Defiant. So I would say at the time that she's introduced, the Defiant doesn't quite fit any particular role. But once you get the next generation of ships, so the Saber class, the Norways, the Steamrunners, the Sovereigns, possibly by some arguments, the Akiras, the Prometheuses, etc., Promethei maybe, then at that point in the new Starfleet, the Defiant very much fits the role of a large destroyer. Michael D'Antoni asks, if Russia was actually able to build and launch the Project 24s in the 1950s, do you think the US would have responded with the Montana class or with more Iowa class battleships? I don't think they would have done the Montanas because the Montanas were long gone. They'd been broken up on the stocks even before World War II ended. And, you know, overall armament and performance-wise, the Iowas would have been a comfortable match, at least for the realistic Project 24s that kind of sort of got to the final design stage. I think there's two ways the US could go. One would be obviously just bringing the four existing Iowas back into full-line frontline service and leaving it at that, perhaps with a few upgrades, and otherwise relying on aircraft, much in the way that when the Soviets started spamming Sverdlovs, instead of retaining Vanguard or a meaningful cruiser fleet, the Royal Navy went, okay, well, we'll keep Belfast and one other cruiser around, and we're going to rest most of our hopes in the Blackburn Buccaneer. The US Navy might also therefore have gone, well, yeah, we'll have the Iowas around as a backstop, but we're going to rely primarily on aircraft to keep us happy. But while I think the US definitely would have looked into, perhaps in more detail, large strike aircraft with specific anti-battleship strike weapons, because of course it's a heavily armored target, it needs a slightly different attack profile than cruisers and destroyers. The other thing the US might well have considered would be to take the hulls of Kentucky and Illinois, the 5th and 6th Iowas, and finish them in a kind of updated Iowa design to give them 6 Iowas to counter however many Project 24s the Soviets had, and couple that with the American carrier strength and some niche heavy anti-ship missiles, that probably would have been the US answer. Paul Miklansinski asks, would you consider making an episode on the Royal Navy's blunders and incompetence, starting with World War I onwards? The whole video should be about bad strategies, unnecessary losses, failed strategies, and missed opportunities, etc. I think definitely there is some mileage in doing an episode on things that went horribly wrong, and dividing it up by Navy certainly does make sense. I think the only question in my mind would be that I think that there's two very distinct lines of video in there. You could do a video on things that went wrong or failed very badly, but quite often those things may not necessarily be down to blunders or incompetence. It's just the fortunes of war. You know, you did a thing, the enemy did a thing, the enemy did their thing better, you lost. And in some cases, quite spectacularly. So, for example, something like the loss of HMS Barham, you know, that's a very significant loss. Yes, there is a certain degree of a missed opportunity there because the U-boat was technically detected, it just wasn't acted upon. The same, a similar thing you could say to a certain degree for Courageous. But there's a lot of discussion to be had about that, and even Ark Royal. But I wouldn't necessarily characterize, certainly at least the loss of Ark Royal or Barham, as a blunder or an incompetence in the full manner. You could make more arguments about Courageous, I think, versus a video where you could point to a thing and go, look, this all went horribly wrong, and here's an extensive list of the reasons why, i.e. this was a bad idea from the start, run by incompetent people who got a lot of people killed unnecessarily. And those two things are rather different. But depending on which one people were more interested in seeing, yeah, I could certainly look into a video about the Royal Navy's various missed opportunities, blunders, or things that went spectacularly wrong. And then if that's popular, might follow up with the other navies as well. Josh Thomas Moore asks, which of Warspite's battles, Matapan or Narvik, was more devastating for the Axis, given the ships they lost and the effect they had on those nations' fleets? I would say quite easily Narvik. Matapan was in and of itself obviously something of an unmitigated disaster. You lose 3 out of the 4 Zara-class heavy cruisers. It's, and some destroyers as well, it's not a good day to be the Regia Mariner. However, as the dust settled, the Regia Mariner still had notionally 4 heavy cruisers on the books. They had the 2 Trentos, the Bolzano, and the Gorizia, the remaining Zara class, obviously in varying levels of repair, but they physically owned those hulls. And they still had plenty of destroyers, and Vittorio Veneto got away, which was probably by far the more important thing. If Vittorio Veneto had been crippled and stationary instead of Pola, we could be talking a very different idea of which one was the more crippling. But at the end of the day, it meant that the Italians still had a good chunk of their heavy cruisers around. The Royal Navy still didn't have heavy cruisers in the Mediterranean, and the Regia Mariner was able to continue operating, albeit obviously in a slightly reduced manner. For comparison purposes, if the Kriegsmarine had lost 3 heavy cruisers in a similar ambush, then, accounting for the fact Blücher's already been taken out by the Norwegians, they would have been left with precisely 1 heavy cruiser. And that's if you're counting the Deutschland class as heavy cruisers. If you're just looking at the Hippers, it would have left them with -1 cruiser, which would have been impressive. But then you flip over to Narvik, and although the biggest thing the Germans lose at Narvik is a destroyer, they have far fewer destroyers to start with, and the destroyers that are at Narvik are some of their latest and greatest, which means that, you know, their destroyer fleet is badly crippled by Narvik and the Norwegian campaign generally. And this has huge knock-on effects on what the Germans are able to do with the Kriegsmarine surface force going further on into the war. Now, of course, they're not going to send destroyers out into the Atlantic with the Scharnhorst or Bismarck or the Deutschlands or the Hippers or whatever. But when you look at the stuff that they did try and do, so various coastal operations, later on fighting against 10th Destroyer Flotilla, various other operations running blockade runners in and out of French ports, escorting Tirpitz, Scharnhorst, Lützow, etc. in Arctic raids, etc., etc. All of these things really require destroyers, and they just don't have that many, especially after Narvik. And so they're constantly forced to put up with putting out smaller destroyer forces than perhaps they ideally would. Now, of course, there are fuel restrictions as the war goes on as well, but of course, destroyers use significantly less fuel than full-on capital ships, and I certainly think the German coastal warfare, given what their coastal U-boats and their Schnellboote got up to, certainly could have been significantly improved if they'd had a reasonably large destroyer fleet to, you know, sail out and either back up their lighter forces or do their own raiding in the North Sea, the English Channel, the Bay of Biscay, etc. So I think knock-on effects on the Kriegsmarine for losing all those destroyers at Narvik was certainly a lot greater than the knock-on effects of losing the 3 heavy cruisers for the Regia Mariner at Matapan. Tom Prick-Vixen asks, why were only destroyer caliber secondaries, aka 5-inch guns, ever put on US battleships, as in dreadnought battleships, and nothing larger? Sure, just before World War II, dual-purpose versions made more sense, but in the 1910s and late up through to the late 1920s, it may have been of more benefit to have a few cruiser-caliber guns as well, 6 to 8 inch, like on some other battleships. So the rest of the crew of said battleship had something to operate if they encountered something like an enemy scouting fleet made of heavy cruisers and battle cruisers, especially considering that the US standard battleship family had a worse rate of fire on its main guns than some similar enemy's guns. And the US fleet was very short on cruisers until the late 30s or so. There are a variety of reasons when we're talking about the 1910s to the 1920s. At this point, the 5-inch gun isn't actually the standard gun on US destroyers. That will come somewhat later. So it's not for commonality across the fleet. It's more to do with the fact that when it comes to the dreadnought battleship and selecting your secondary gun, what you essentially want is a shell that, with 1 or 2 hits, is strong enough to cripple or destroy an incoming torpedo boat or destroyer, and not really that much bigger, because if you hit a torpedo boat, let's say with a 5 or a 6 inch shell, sure, it'll probably stop. If you hit it with an 8 inch shell, it'll probably also stop. But the 8 inch gun is going to be considerably heavier, and therefore you're going to have considerably fewer of them, and they're also going to be firing at a slower rate, because, you know, heavier shells and so forth, they're going to need a lot more complicated loading equipment. And so there's no real benefit and plenty of disadvantages to having a dreadnought secondary battery at, say, a 7-8 inch caliber. And so when the US Navy is looking at what kind of gun it can mount on its battleships, it looks around and it thinks, well, okay, the 5-inch gun offers quite a decent amount of hitting power against period destroyers. And compared to a 6-inch gun, which some, or 5.9-inch, etc., which quite a lot of other navies adopted, the British going from a 4-inch to a 6-inch gun midway through their super dreadnought period, the 5-inch gun hits harder and has a longer range than the 4-inch gun, is not that much weaker than a 6-inch gun, but the 5-inch gun weighs a little bit less, takes up a little bit less space, so you can have more of them, or you can put more weight into other parts of the ship. And the 5-inch 51 fires a little bit faster than a 6-inch gun. So not only can you have slightly more guns, but you can put out considerably more shells per minute, which makes it more likely that you're going to hit enemy destroyers. And if the 5-inch shell, in your estimation, can put down enemy destroyers almost as well as a 6-inch gun, then there's no real reason for you to upgrade. And so they stick with the 5-inch. Putting anything heavier than a 6-inch gun on, or in the US case a 5-inch, gets you into the realm, as we said, of you're going to go past the point where you can use quick-firing technology. So for the 1910s and 1920s, a 7, 8-inch, 9-inch, 10-inch gun is just not practical for use as against destroyers. And if you are going to try and use them against enemy cruisers, battle cruisers, etc., well, there's a few things to take into account. Firstly, for every, let's say, 8-inch gun you put in, you're going to take away quite a few 5-inch guns, so your protection against destroyers has gone down quite dramatically. And if you've only got 2, 3, or 4 8-inch guns, the appreciable firepower against an enemy cruiser or battle cruiser is pretty insignificant. And also, you know, if you're going to have a decent anti-destroyer battery and some 8-inch guns, you might end up having to consider dropping some of your main battery, which also isn't really particularly brilliant, at which point you might as well have a large anti-torpedo boat battery and a large main battery, and if the enemy shows up with cruisers or battle cruisers, you shoot them with the fact that you're lots and lots of main guns, your 12, 14-inch guns, for example. And those guns against enemy cruisers and battle cruisers have considerably longer range, considerably more hitting power, and have access to considerably better fire control than a small smattering of 8-inch guns would. Now, once you get in well into the interwar period, you also have the advantage of, at that point, your new cruisers and your destroyers are all using 5-inch guns as well, so there's a commonality of caliber, a certain commonality of ammunition, and so on and so forth. Not entirely, because there are some shells, the 5-inch 51 can use that the 5-inch 25 and 5-inch 38 can't, but there's a broad commonality of shells. And of course, if you've got 5-inch 51s, then calculating the weight and space requirements to replace those later on with 5-inch 25s or 5-inch 38s is pretty easy. The issue is that unless you go for really, really big, which pre-Washington Treaty Congress isn't willing to fund, and post-Washington Treaty you can't unless you break the treaty regulations, going really, really big, oversized compared to everyone else, is the only way that you're going to get a meaningful intermediate battery and essentially recreate the pre-dreadnought to deal with the fact you don't have a lot of cruisers. And at that point, well, you might as well just build a lot of cruisers, because they're going to be much better platforms for fighting enemy cruisers than an intermediate battery on your battleship is going to be, because your battleship really should be focused on enemy capital ships fending off enemy destroyers, and if enemy cruisers show up, well, your big guns can essentially do the same thing to them that your secondary guns can do to destroyers. Namely, you know, if a cruiser takes a couple of 14-inch rounds or 16-inch rounds, they're not going to be in a good way. Whereas a cruiser could potentially tank off an 8-inch hit or two. Gord M. asks, why were E-boats so horribly ineffective in the Bay de Seine between the nights of June 5th and 7th, 1944? The only defence I constantly see is Allied smoke screens. So this is essentially covering the relatively ineffective Schnellboot attacks on the Allied invasion fleet off of the Normandy coast. And there's a variety of reasons why these attacks weren't particularly successful. One of which was, between Allied intel and recon and intercepted radio messages, they knew they were coming. And one of the big advantages of the Schnellboot was stealth. You know, they're not particularly durable. They're not massively heavily armed. If you end up going up against major enemy warships and they know you're coming, you're in for a very bad day. And, well, the Allied warships knew that they were coming, so they were on the lookout. The next factor, of course, was numbers and weight. So if you've got three or four Schnellboot going after a corvette or maybe an escort destroyer, sure, that could be a problem. When the Allied escorts on the Normandy beaches vastly outnumber the number of Schnellboote you physically possess, let alone the number you can actually deploy to a particular operation, now you have a problem because there's far too many heavy guns pointing in your direction. And for a Schnellboote, anything above a 20 mil is a heavy gun. And then you also have radar. So the Allied smoke screens help because it means that the Schnellboote, obviously, which don't carry big radars of their own, can't necessarily see what's waiting ahead of them. The Allies, of course, do have plenty of radar, and at this point they're using microwave radar, so they have the notice that the Schnellboote are coming. They vastly outnumber them in terms of ships that are armed with guns that can quite happily deal with them, and then their own radar picks up the incoming Schnellboote. So if you know the enemy's coming, you can see them coming, you have a vastly overwhelming amount of firepower, and the smoke screens mean that the Schnellboote can't see just exactly what kind of reception is waiting for them until almost the last minute. Well, yeah, at that point, finding the Allied invasion fleet in the dark is one thing, but then when you do find it, it turns out there's an awful lot of angry people pointing lots of high explosive at you, and your main choice is break and run, because even a 4-inch HE shell will properly mess up an S-boat. And to give you some idea of just how good Allied intel was at this point, it was down to a per-ship level. So when the Schnellboote set out on the night of June 6th to try and counter the initial Allied invasion, not only did the Allies know that they were coming, they even knew that they were specifically going to try and hit Warspite, and they knew that the Germans knew where Warspite was, so they actually swapped out Warspite with Belfast because, yes, Warspite did have some secondary batteries, but Belfast had more secondaries, more 6-inch guns. Obviously, they weren't secondaries for Belfast. Plus, it had 4-inch secondaries. And, of course, Belfast's 6-inch guns, as well as being more numerous, were fully in turrets and served by a full fire control system, as opposed to just the secondary fire control on Warspite. And ultimately, if Belfast got hit, it wasn't going to be as significant a problem as if Warspite got hit in the grand scheme of things. So that helped. I mean, Warspite wasn't too far away and did greet incoming German fast attack craft with 15-inch gunfire as well. But it just by being a little bit out of position, it threw the Germans off quite a bit. Warrant Officer Will asks, did anyone during the period this channel covers ever consider using steam motors like those found on the V-19-1001 locomotive? I know that turbines are probably superior, but what stopped them from being used instead of triple expansion engines? So for those who are unaware, a steam motor in this case, although contextually steam motor gets used a lot in a lot of different applications, but in terms of the thing like it's being used on this steam locomotive and others, is essentially, if you imagine a compound or triple expansion engine, or even a quadruple expansion engine for that matter, but instead of using very large single pistons and crankshafts, or in the case of the lower expansion stage, possibly two, the steam motor uses a bunch of smaller pistons running at higher speed rather than just the one big one, let's say. And that does lead to a few savings. There are advantages and disadvantages. When it comes to steam locomotives, one of the primary savings is space, and which is obviously a premium on something like a railway locomotive. The thing is, while you can get a slightly more compact engine and obviously something that's running at quite high speed, which is quite useful for, you know, steam engines that are supposed to run at very high velocities, those are less advantageous when it comes to ships, because ships generally don't lack for space comparatively in their engine compartments. And you run into the problem which initially turbines also ran into, which is that if you're running at a speed that is, in terms of RPM, which is significantly beyond that which the ship actually needs to move, then you can't do a direct drive connection anymore. You have to put in a geared connection. And bear in mind that when they introduced turbines, it took a while for people to manufacture gearing sets of the appropriate size and durability to downrate turbines to the point where the RPM was suitable, more suitable for use in driving a ship forward. So essentially, by the time full ship gear sets were available for turbines, well, turbines were available and turbines were better than a steam motor, because a steam motor had a lot of the same issues as a vertical triple expansion engine in terms of things like energy loss, the amount of oil and steam and vibration that got thrown around, etc. And of course, they were slightly more complex because you had lots and lots of very high speed moving parts as opposed to fewer, larger, and therefore stronger, slower moving parts. Now, in theory, in the period after the steam motor was invented, but before the steam turbine was put onto ships, you could, in theory, make an argument that perhaps an early invention of a ship-borne gear set would have allowed you to have a geared steam motor instead of just a standard vertical triple expansion engine. But then you would have run into the issues of, well, one, you've got to invent and install said massive gearing system. Two, said gearing system is going to take up more space, more weight, more cost, which obviously people who are looking to save as much money as possible are not going to be that attracted by. And as I said, because you've got lots and lots of crankshafts all moving at very high speeds, it's a much more complex motor with potentially things that could go wrong compared to your standard vertical or quadruple expansion engine. And therefore, for a warship that needs a nice, reliable system, you're probably not gaining a huge amount and you're losing a fair bit in terms of reliability, ease of maintenance, and so on and so forth. So it's just not really, there's not enough advantages to use it in a large-scale warship situation, at least. Redosaurus asks, if the Derfflinger-class battlecruisers had the armour and firepower, at least in gun calibre and broadside, of early British battleships, why aren't they classified as fast battleships by modern naval historians? And, yeah, this is a fair question to raise because, well, early British battleships, Dreadnought, Bellerophon, St. Vincent, the Dreadnought and its derivatives, as you might say, they all have 8-gun broadsides. Derfflinger has an 8-gun broadside, and both the British early Dreadnoughts and the Derfflinger are using 12-inch guns. Armour thickness is similar. In some areas, Derfflinger actually has slightly thicker belt armour. And, of course, it's just very fast, so surely it should just be a fast battleship. But the thing is, we have to rate like against like, at least in terms of time period. And that's very important during the Anglo-German naval arms race, because capabilities change very, very rapidly. If you look at when the Derfflingers are actually built in 1912 and 1913, is when the various ships are laid down, that overlaps with the Iron Dukes and the Queen Elizabeths in Royal Navy service. Now, whilst there isn't a huge amount to distinguish between the armour thickness of the Derfflingers and the Iron Dukes, the Queen Elizabeths do have a slightly thicker armour belt. However, this is where you start to see some of the differences between a battleship and a battlecruiser, because the overall height of a battleship's armour belt at full thickness, when, you know, we're not looking at the thinner armour strikes above or below, So the 11.8-inch thick section of Derfflinger's belt versus the 12-inch section of Iron Duke's belt or the 13-inch section of Queen Elizabeth's belt, the battleship's belt is taller, so it covers a greater area. Also, generally, when you look at battleships, they tend to have their main armour belt and therefore main armour deck also extend a little bit further than on battlecruisers, which tend to try and stick to the absolute minimum possible needed to defend their citadel. And although, as you can see from this picture of Derfflinger, she does have a distributed armour scheme, so there's armour on the bow, armour on the stern. Again, both when you're looking outside of the main belt, the battleship's distributed armour overall will usually be slightly thicker and possibly also cover slightly more than a battlecruiser's, although flavour may vary depending on exact location and ship. And of course, compared to those two ships, while Derfflinger is faster than either, those ships have considerably more firepower, 10 13.5-inch guns versus 8 12-inch guns, or 8 15-inch guns versus 8 12-inch guns. So at that point, you can see that Derfflinger very definitely has considerable inferiority to either of those ships in everything but speed, and therefore, well, she's a battlecruiser. If you compare Derfflinger to Dreadnought, well, you're looking at around about 7 years between the laying down of Dreadnought and the laying down of Derfflinger. And if you're going to do that, well, then if you take, say, the Lion-class battlecruisers and you dial back 7 years, so from her laydown date in 1909 to 1902, well, at that point, British and German pre-dreadnoughts that are being laid down have between 7 and 9 inches of belt armour. And Lion has 9 inches of belt armour. And Lion has considerably more and heavier guns than they do. So does that make Lion a fast battleship because she actually outguns battleships that are 7 years older than her, has similar armour and higher speed? Or if you want to get even more absurd, look at the Invincible class. And the Invincible class, obviously initially laid down in 1906. If you go 7 and a bit years back, you're looking at the last of the Canopus class and the last of the Kaiser Friedrich the Third class in Britain and Germany, respectively, being laid down. And those ships have 6 inches of armour. The Invincibles have 6 inches of armour, but the Invincibles have twice as many guns and are faster. Therefore, the Invincibles would be fast battleships. So, I mean, yes, both of those examples are a little bit absurd. And obviously, neither the Lion nor the Invincible is a fast battleship. But it kind of illustrates just how fast technology is advancing, because a period of 7 years, the Invincibles and the Lions arguably have considerably more advantages over the pre-dreadnoughts that predate them by about 7 to 8 years, as compared to the advantages that Derfflinger has over Dreadnought, wherein, you know, basically the only advantage she has is speed. And that is basically why you have to compare like with like in terms of when a ship is laid down. Vicky asks a number of armour questions and a couple of related ones, so I'm going to answer them quickfire style and mention them as we go. Question one is essentially to do with sloping armour and the fact that sloping armour works best at longer ranges, but at longer ranges, when shells are falling at steeper angles, they're also falling considerably slower. So wouldn't it be better to slope the armour back the other way, like you find on, say, the CSS Virginia, because that will increase the apparent armour thickness at closer ranges where you need absolutely every last inch of apparent thickness to protect yourself. So for that, the problem becomes that by the time people are considering sloped armour as a protective system, so you're talking about in terms of implementing it on dreadnoughts, basically from the early 1920s onwards, The problem you have is that at very close ranges, so let's say under 10,000 yards, the punching power of modern naval guns has gotten to such a point that it's really probably not going to make much difference on realistic armor thicknesses whether your armor is vertical, sloped outwards, or sloped inwards. Because even at relatively flat trajectories, you're still getting a little bit of advantage from sloped outward armor, not as much as you get from sloped inward, but still some. But if someone's shooting at you at, let's, I don't know, say 8,000 yards, then for an early 16-inch gun, so a Colorado gun, Nelson's guns, that Nagato's guns, that kind of stuff, you're looking at penetration values of well over 20 inches. and it, with a plausible thickness of armor belt, let's say a 13-inch armor belt, to get even something that's going to remotely stop that kind of firepower, you'd have to be laying your armor belt back at an angle of 60 degrees off vertical. So even more angled back than you would have on a casemate ironclad of the American Civil War period, which at that point your angles are almost approaching that of the protected deck concept, at which point you've kind of just made a battleship into a giant heavily armored protected cruiser. And the weight of armor that you're going to need, because you're now essentially doing a protected deck concept instead of a belt concept, is going to be absurdly heavy because of obviously the much greater surface area you're going to need to be using. So it's just impractical. Whereas if you go out to, you know, let's say early 1920s battle ranges, 15 to 20,000 yards or so, maybe pushing a little bit more, but realistically probably 15 to 20,000 yards, at that range, the armor-piercing capability of your big new naval guns, mostly the 16 inches, but 15 inches to a certain extent as well, is still within the bounds of being able to punch through a 12 or 13 inch armor belt if it's just sitting there vertically, but not by much. You're talking about an inch or two penetration potentially, beyond obviously the thickness of the armor, at which point angling your armor outwards and increasing the apparent thickness somewhat, that actually pushes you into the area where you now have protection. So the actual battle ranges you'll be fighting at, it does make sense. And unfortunately, at the kind of ranges where sloping the armor back the other way, casemate ironclad style, would cause any significant increase in apparent armor thickness, the ridiculous levels of penetration at that kind of close range from shells completely negate and overmatch any benefit you'd get. Plus then, of course, at the longer ranges, you're now presenting the face of your armor to the incoming shells dropping down from higher up, which makes the penetration easier. And the second question is that the thick, heavy steel structure of an armor-piercing shell serves two main purposes: maximizing the shell's sectional density, which maximizes its ability to punch through armor upon impact and retain energy during flight in the face of aerodynamic drag, and maximizing the shell's strength so it doesn't just break up on impact. For armor-piercing shells in the early 20th century, was the entire thickness of the shell structure needed to avoid shell breakup, or were they, in pursuit of sectional density, made thicker than was strictly necessary? And if the latter, could shell performance have been increased by perhaps thinning down the steel portion of the shell to just what was necessary to keep the shell intact upon impact, and replacing some or all of the removed metal with a much denser material like lead, thus allowing for a more powerful bursting charge? And did any navies actually try this? So due to the sheer amount of force involved in impacting heavy armor plate, especially obviously face-hardened armor plate with shells, you do need pretty much all of the thickness of a shell just to avoid it breaking up from the force of the impact. Of course, having the slightly detached, only loosely attached, whether it might be a clips or solder, armor-piercing cap helps a little bit in terms of that absorption, and the armor-piercing cap to a certain extent also sacrifices itself. But any substantial hollowing out of the armor-piercing shell does actually reduce its strength quite considerably, to the point that it's not going to make it through any significant thickness of armor without then breaking up as it goes, and then obviously at that point you get some form of detonation. So, for example, when you have CPC shells, which the British invent prior to World War One, which are essentially they're sort of semi-armor-piercing shells. They have a full armor-piercing cap on them, but they do almost what you describe, in that they have much bigger bursting charge and much thinner walls as a result, or somewhat thinner walls as a result, with a full AP cap on the front. But they are rated for considerably less armor-penetrating value, partly because, yeah, they are a little bit lighter, so at longer ranges they're going to hit a little bit less heavily. But bearing in mind that CPC shells are 1900s era weapons, for the most part, at the kind of ranges they're thinking about hitting, their force of impact, their speed of impact is not going to be much less than a standard armor-piercing shell, but the strength of the shell overall is considerably weaker, and that goes a long way into why they just can't penetrate as much. So the rule of thumb before full penetration tables were worked out tended to be that an armor-piercing shell could be expected, at least at the earlier battle ranges, to penetrate its own caliber in armor thickness, whereas a CPC shell, depending on which formula used, would either penetrate one-third or one-half of its caliber, which was great against distributed armor, not so great against the main armor belt. And of course, if the shell weighs more, because I don't put lead or tungsten or something in there, then it's going to have more energy, which means more energy on impact. So a heavier shell with a thinner wall is going to suffer even more stress, which means it's even more likely to break up. So there is some variance that you can do, which is part of the reason why British shells tend to have bigger bursting charges than most other nations for a given caliber. But even the relatively speaking, compared to what the kind of thing you're proposing, smaller changes that the British shells have, do have some interesting effects on the shell's capacity to penetrate, especially when you are looking at more off-angle impacts. And that's followed up by two questions that are fairly quick to answer, both also by Vicky. Could Enterprise and Hornet have intercepted Shigaku and Zuikaku as the latter retreated from Coral Sea? And if so, what would have been the knock-on effects? Theoretically, yes, in as much as Enterprise and Hornet were in a position such that, I mean, they fainted at Nauru, for example. They could have proceeded at high speed, kind of southwest, westward, into roughly the same area that Shikaku and Zuikaku would have been in as they progressed northwest, having gone around the Solomon Islands to head home at around about the same time. But without any real clue as to where they were, the chances of the two forces stumbling across each other are very remote, and it would have been putting Enterprise and Hornet in an extremely vulnerable position. Now, the US did actually deploy submarines in various picket lines to try and find Shikaku and Zuikaku and obviously sink them. So you could hypothesize that maybe a submarine spots at least the escort forces, and indeed at one point one of the US submarines did spot some Japanese destroyers and vector the US ships in that way. But realistically speaking, the chances of successfully finding and intercepting Shikaku and Zuikaku before they're far too deep in Japanese territory or Japanese held territory is slim to none. And obviously the longer they keep looking, the more chances they have of being hit themselves by Japanese land-based bombers from places like Rabaul. And finally, a quick one, how many expansion stages did the Casablanca's Uniflow reciprocating engines use? The sources I've looked at don't seem to mention this detail. So the Casablanca class are supposed to have used two quadruple expansion five-cylinder Uniflow engines. So that would be obviously quadruple expansion, four expansion stages, and presumably the five cylinders are because, as with vertical triple expansion engines, sometimes the final expansion stage presumably has two cylinders as opposed to one, which, as I said, is relatively common with vertical triple expansion engines as well in some cases. Sir George Tryon asks, how would RMS Olympic perform as a carrier conversion? The only trouble I see is her power plant, but if you're going through the trouble of stripping her down, I could imagine them replacing it. Now, that's an interesting scenario, because, of course, historically, the Olympic class, obviously, which includes Titanic and Britannic as well as Olympic, you've in theory got one low-pressure turbine, two reciprocating engines, and everything's powered by coal and old-school-style boilers because of, well, the time period that they were built in. However, Olympic is still around in the 1930s, which does propose an interesting alternate history wherein the Royal Navy wants more carriers, and maybe they want a supplement to Ark Royal, the kind of overseas ocean Pacific carrier, rather than the armoured close-in carriers with the Illustriouses that are being built. So maybe they're building the Illustriouses, but think, okay, well, you know, this ship's going out of service. We could potentially get another carrier out of it while also being relatively cheap. Now, I say relatively because stripping out all the coal bunkers, replacing it with small tube boilers, oil firing, and turbines wouldn't be really cheap. It would still be fairly expensive, but it'd probably be cheaper than building a whole brand new carrier. And that would address probably the single largest issue, which would be speed. Obviously, very low 20s of knots in the default configuration. I mean, strip off all that superstructure and, okay, yeah, fair enough, you're going to lighten the ship, but then you're putting a hangar deck and a flight deck on top, so you're adding weight back on. But you're certainly massively reducing the size of the machinery and therefore also the weight. You might find yourself also putting some bulges on, because let's face it, even at the time, as demonstrated with Titanic and certainly by the 30s, the, shall we say, watertight integrity in case of foreign objects from the outside trying to poke holes in it on the Olympic class is not necessarily the greatest. I mean, it's not the worst, but it's definitely not the best. But the really interesting thing is that I think if you'd had done that and fully converted her, she actually would have made a pretty darn good carrier. And before you reach for your torches and pitchforks, let me explain. She would be the single largest carrier the Royal Navy ever possessed up until the modern era when we built the Queen Elizabeth class. And so, yeah, put the torches and pitchforks away. Yeah, now, technically, yes, the Audacious class did have a wider beam than the Olympics did, but they were still shorter and displaced slightly less. And then if you look at the Implacables have a similar beam and are shorter, and everything before them is also smaller, including the Ark Royal of the 1930s. The Olympic class were pretty darn big. I mean, that by default, in this picture, she's just a fraction over 880 feet long. That means she's just over 20 foot longer than Hood, and she's within shouting distance of Lexington. There's literally less than 10 feet between the two of them. And of course, that's with Olympic in her liner configuration. If she has an overhang fore and aft for her flight deck, she might actually technically be longer than Lexington. Now, granted, she's going to be somewhat narrower than Lexington. The Lexingtons have a beam of well over 100 feet, whereas the Olympic's beam is just over 90 feet. But thanks in part to her liner origins and slightly older design style, Olympic actually maintains her beam for considerably longer than Lexington, which is also interesting because if you're going to shove a bunch more power into her to get her moving faster, she's certainly got the length to beam ratio for it, but you might want to slap a bow extension on just to make the bow lines a little bit finer. So in theory, a mid to late 1930s carrier conversion of Olympic could give you an incredibly capable carrier for the Royal Navy. Their main problem would be finding enough fleet air arm aircraft to fill it up. Just don't let it go into the central Mediterranean because, well, it would be quite vulnerable to being bombed and torpedoed as compared to an Illustrious or something. But hey, as long as you keep it away from the odd U-boat in the Straits of Gibraltar, she should perform similar or better than Ark Royal. Brian Stevens asks, what was the most successful pirate nation in the Age of Sail? Was it the people of the Barbary Coast? Well, in terms of actually, having a nation, then yes, hands down, the Barbary Corsairs have to win the prize for most successful pirate nation in the Age of Sail on two counts. One, obviously actually having a nation, which most pirate factions didn't tend to manage. And secondly, on account of their sheer longevity, because they're around for hundreds of years, and they're able to amass fabulous amounts of wealth and also play off various European powers against each other for a very, very long period of time. And it takes multiple attacks by multiple navies over time, and they bounce back from every one. And it's only really in the beginning of the 19th century when you get first the US Navy showing up with the First and Second Barbary Wars, then Pellew, aka Lord Exmouth, showing up and just basically flattening all military capability in Algiers in 1816, and then the French showing up with the British show up a couple of times in between to try and keep their behaviour online, and then when it's clear that they're not, then the French show up in the beginning of the 1830s and just go, okay, this is stupid, we're taking you over. So it takes attacks from two great powers and one rising power in sequence, plus a land invasion, to actually finish off the Barbary Corsairs, which is something that no other pirate nation can really claim. The only competition I think they would have would be some of the Chinese pirate factions that grew and then obviously fell over time during what would loosely classify as the Age of Sail. And in some ways, you could argue they were somewhat more successful than the Barbary Corsairs because they actually got to the point where they could directly influence the Chinese central government and the various provincial governments of China because of the absolutely massive fleets that they had. So whereas the Barbary Corsairs had to play various European powers off against each other because they knew that if they didn't, then a particularly annoyed European power with a decent amount of firepower could show up and really ruin things. The Chinese pirate factions got to a point where they could actually just dominate the seas despite the Chinese Navy's best efforts to deal with them and could influence power politics directly. The only disqualifier based on your question would be the fact that those pirate groups, while they had enclaves, they never formed their own, as far as I'm aware, separate long-term nations with self-governance the way that the Barbary Corsairs did. Slow Pixie asks, taking a break from unnecessary articulated questions, I wanted to ask, could you make a quick comparison of the anti-aircraft suites of Tirpitz and Yamato in their final configuration, including both guns and directors? And how do you think Tirpitz would have fared had she been in place of Yamato and Musashi during their respective last stands, taking into account the differences in armor and torpedo protection? So it's a little bit of a game of swings and roundabouts when you're looking purely at the directors and the guns themselves. So both ships actually have four main gun directors for their heavy anti-aircraft suites, at least as far as I can find. However, in that regard, I think Tirpitz wins out because although both ships have four, the Tirpitz's directors are directing more and more capable anti-aircraft guns because, of course, Tirpitz has the 105mm anti-aircraft gun, whereas the Yamato is using the 5-inch gun. Now, the 5-inch gun, the Japanese one, is a little bit larger, obviously. Now, while the Type 89 5-inch gun isn't the sort of somewhat slow and cumbersome 5-inch dual-purpose gun you find on Japanese destroyers, it's a slightly different model, it is, however, believe it or not, actually shorter range and lower velocity than the German 4-inch. And the German 4-inch can also kick out a lot more shells per minute. So the German gun is going to be firing faster and further, and therefore is just overall a more effective weapon. So in terms of heavy anti-aircraft suite, Tirpitz gets the biscuit there. In terms of lighter anti-aircraft weapons, so lighter medium AA guns, Tirpitz is unfortunately still cursed with the single shot 37mm. So, I mean, it's there. It might do something. And it does have the advantage of, if you look at both sides, both ships, short and medium at range anti-aircraft batteries, the 37mm, assuming the rather desultory number of shots it can put into this guy, actually hit something, they can actually hit something at a range before weapons release on a number of aircraft that would be attacking it in the hypothetical scenario of Tirpitz taking the place of Yamato and Musashi. So it has some value, but I wouldn't, you know, hold my breath on it. And then on the light end of things, the Japanese ship has around about twice as many 25mm barrels as the Germans have 20mm. And the German 20mm is somewhat shorter range than the 25mm, although both weapons are too short range to engage attacking aircraft before they drop their weapons. So that difference is perhaps relatively minor by 1945. The German guns have slightly more ammunition per magazine, which is good, but they also fire faster, which is good when you're firing an aircraft, but it does mean that actually in terms of when you have to reload, they're actually very similar in terms of how long they can fire before they reload, except that the German guns do have a slight advantage in that respect, in that at least for the quad 20mm flak mounts, you can in theory fire two of the guns, and then when those run out of ammunition and you need to reload them, you can reload those while the other two guns are firing, which obviously gives you more sustained fire, which will help you tear up aircraft that are perhaps getting a bit too close. They've dropped their weapons, so you can inflict at least casualties on them, even if you can't stop them dropping their bomb or torpedo. Or for strafing aircraft like Hellcats, you can discourage them from coming back again with more sustained fire. And the 20mm German gun is a little bit more accurate than the 25mm. But of course, the Japanese 25mm, there's a huge number more of them. So depending on exactly how much you weight each of those factors, you could argue one or the other is a little bit better. But I would say for light and medium AA suites, just purely on the guns themselves, it's probably around about a wash. However, then there's the big factor, which I haven't mentioned so far, and I'm sure some people have been throwing things at the screen about, and that is the fact that Tirpitz has a fully comprehensive radar suite, including direct radar guidance for her anti-aircraft suite. And that is a cut above what Yamato has. Yamato does have radar, but it is not dedicated fire control radar, and it's not linked to her anti-aircraft systems in the way that Tirpitz's or indeed a British or American ships would be. Now, there are smaller relays and fire control systems for the light and medium anti-aircraft suite, but I'm not going to go into those in particular detail, mostly because, as I said, by the time the 20mm or the 25mm systems are engaging, the Avengers or the Helldivers or whatever have already dropped their ordnance. So that's mostly around, you know, again, deterring strafing Hellcats or taking vengeance on an aircraft that's already attacked you. The 37mm suite on the Germans' side, again, possibly could engage Avengers and Helldivers before they do weapons release, but it's still going to be a little marginal. So all things considered, I think Tirpitz actually has the better of the AA suites, certainly, mostly thanks to that radar guidance and also thanks to just having a considerably heavy anti-aircraft gun broadside, not just because of the numbers, but also rate of fire. But how would Tirpitz fare in place of Yamato or Musashi during their respective last stands? Well, she would take a few more aircraft with her. She's a little bit faster as well, which is going to make her a slightly more difficult target, at least until the hits start rolling in and she slows down. However, she is also somewhat smaller displacement-wise than a Yamato class, which means that once those hits start landing, she's not going to be able to absorb as many of those hits. And her torpedo defense system, while it's okay, is also, again, less massive than the Japanese system. So I think, weirdly enough, her overall fate might actually be very similar if you substituted her in with Yamato and Musashi, because it would take longer for the American aircraft to actually start scoring meaningful hits on her, because she'd be inflicting more casualties and she'd be more difficult to hit. But once they do start getting those hits in, she would go down somewhat faster, and thus overall, from start of engagement to end of engagement, the timeline would probably be fairly similar. And of course, possibly somewhat shorter if an American aircraft gets a good hit in quite early on, for, you know, a torpedo or bomb hit to the bow, for example, that forces her to slow down, and then suddenly she's really in for it. She will take more aircraft with her than Musashi or Yamato did, but she's not getting out alive. Pedden Harley asks, could you give us a brief history of fresh water supplies for crew use rather than boiler feed water aboard ships during the period that the channel covers? How did the storage of water evolve? And what were the challenges regarding keeping it fresh? How was it delivered to the crew? And when did modern plumbing appear aboard ship? So initially, going way, 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 way back to ancient times, fresh water would largely consist of whatever you happen to be able to carry with you. There would be very minimal fresh water stored aboard a ship, at least a warship, we're talking like triremes and stuff, for the crew as a general thing. But that was in large part because those ships really didn't stay out at sea for all that long. They would, if you look at the accounts, you know, if they're on a long-ish voyage, say from, I know, the eastern coast of Greece over to Sicily, they would very often sail during the day and then fetch up either in harbour or on a beach at night and repeat the same process, at which point just having enough water for each person for a day was relatively easy to do. If you were going to go out to sea for multiple days at a time, then of course you would need to carry a little bit more fresh water with you, or wine or whatever. But then when you sort of fast forward through to the period when ships are staying out to sea for prolonged periods, so late medieval period and into the classic age of sail, then at that point, fresh water supplies are carried aboard ship in casks, or which basically is a form of barrel. Multiple different sizes of barrels are available. And while this fresh water supply was welcome initially, there is, well, two problems. One, making sure that fresh water is clean water, which is a little bit more difficult back in those days. But then secondly, the fact that being stored in a wooden cask, eventually that water is going to start going off. And that can lead to all sorts of problems, which is why you would have, depending on the Navy, various alcoholic rations, and those would then be cut with the water, because that would allow you to essentially bulk out the amount of liquid that you had on board, so, and prevented people from getting absolutely plastered, at least in theory. And also the alcohol would, again, at least in theory, kill most of the nasty stuff that might be developing in the water, so that the whole thing was drinkable, which is why strong spirits like rum were preferred for that kind of thing. But obviously, inevitably, depending on climate, depending on the quality of the barrel, depending on the quality of the water in the first place, you would start to either, well, run out of water, or the water itself would go off. So you'd have to replace it by either a supply ship coming out if you're on blockade duty, or going ashore and refilling your water. Or if you were lucky, you'd get it caught in a rainstorm, and then you could gather the fresh rainwater. And then as you get into the late 18th, early 19th century, you start to see the replacement of water casks made of wood with iron water tanks, which, being non-organic, does tend to preserve the water for somewhat longer, albeit obviously there are issues potentially with rust if the tanks aren't lined properly or treated properly. But generally speaking, a rusty tank will make the water unpalatable but not lethal, and you can filter it much easier than you could treat water in a barrel that's grown interesting green slime. And then, of course, with the advent of steamships around sort of the 1850s, 1860s, and armoured vessels in the 1860s, you also then get to the point where you have condensers and distillation plants aboard, which means you can replenish your fresh water supplies. And that makes everything massively easier, because not only can you consume a lot more fresh water, but the water is going to be fresher at any given point, because it's being topped up by new water. In terms of delivering said water to the crew, obviously on very small ships, you could have water casks which people could just go up to and get water from, although obviously that'd be somewhat regulated. As ships get bigger, first-rate ship of the line, for example, you'd have pipes, usually made of wood, and usually actually made of single pieces of wood as well, interestingly, and these would be connected to pumps, so you could pump water up to certain levels or distribution points. And then, of course, when you're introducing boilers, you're already introducing quite extensive plumbing, because, well, you need to get the water from the tanks to the boilers and back round again through the various treatment systems. And at that point, you start to see the proliferation of other forms of plumbing for delivering fresh water and sewage disposal and so forth. So I'm not sure exactly which the first ship was that had what we might consider to be modern plumbing for water and sewage, but by the 1870s, it was becoming relatively commonplace, at least in parts of the ship. Although, interestingly, plumbing, in terms of at least sewage plumbing, not necessarily freshwater plumbing, has a kind of on-again, off-again history, certainly in officers' quarters aboard various ships, that actually goes way back even into the medieval period and earlier. And for some reason I can't entirely divine, it seems that in one or two medieval battles, so we're talking before the age of cannons mostly, some ships seem to have stored their human waste in barrels and casks rather than just people going over the sides, maybe because the ship was too small and wasn't really set up for that, or because it was designed for a short journey and they thought that would be safer. But in any case, there are a few accounts where these barrels were then either just heaved over or emptied onto people trying to board the ship with appropriately horrific reactions. Although it should be noted that both on ships at that point and even today, almost all sewage systems are saltwater systems rather than using fresh water. It's just plumbing is obviously involved, largely because, well, there's still limited amounts of fresh water on board a ship, and there's no point wasting it on sewage. So it's treatment and flushing if you don't have to. Count Jester asks, I've heard it and seen it written that a battlecruiser is a battleship with some of its armour traded out for more speed. Is this accurate? And have you heard of a ship or class of ships which instead start with a battleship but trade out some of its weapon weight for speed but remain quite well armoured, i.e. armoured as well as a battleship? Basically, something with the speed to keep up with an armour to survive in the line of battle or the modern equivalent, but with a cruiser or less's firepower. Well, either around about the time you're listening to this or potentially shortly thereafter, I do have a video scheduled to come out, which is actually what is a battlecruiser. you'll see from that that there's all sorts of debate as to what exactly such a thing is. About the only real agreement that seems to be universal across all the nations that built battlecruisers is that battlecruisers are supposed to spend at least a decent amount of time as a fleet screen unit blowing away the enemy fleet screen units. Almost everything else about battlecruiser's role differs from navy to navy, although obviously the original flavour battlecruiser, this is HMS New Zealand, so close enough, is supposed to be a cruiser killer first, then a fleet screener, and then a fast wing of the battle line, but not designed to be directly engaged by the enemy battle line. But that's the British conception of the battlecruiser initially, and as said, everyone else has variations on that. But as a general rule of thumb, if you're looking at the contemporary battleship for that nation, usually a battlecruiser can, or you can arrive at roughly the battlecruiser statistics by going minus armor, minus armament, plus speed. Now, minus armor will usually be in terms of both thinner armor and less coverage of armor. That's something people very often forget. But speed, obviously, is quite obvious. They're faster. Firepower is generally going to be less than the equivalent contemporary battleship, but it can take one of two forms. Either they have the same gun, but fewer of them. So, for example, with the British Splendid Cats, by and large, with the exception for Tiger, they're contemporary with the 13.5-inch Super Dreadnoughts, and they have 8 13.5-inch guns versus the battleships with 10. And similarly, you know, Renown and Repulse, they have 15-inch guns. They're roughly contemporaneous with the Queen Elizabeth's and the Revenges. They're slightly later, but near enough, it makes no difference. But they have 6 guns versus the other battleships having 8. But you do get occasions where they might have either a similar number of guns to a battleship, but it might be slightly smaller caliber, or they will have both slightly fewer guns and slightly less caliber. So, for example, the N3 and G3 class battleship battlecruiser pair, they both had 9 guns, but the G3s ended up being designed with 16-inch guns, whereas the N3s had 18-inch guns. But another example would be Seydlitz. Now, she has 10 guns, and the contemporary Kaiser and Koenig class also have 10 guns, but they have 12-inch guns, whereas Seydlitz has 11-inch guns. About the only real exception to that rule in terms of reduction in firepower would be the Amagi Tosa pair that the Japanese were designing, because those are both supposed to have 10 16-inch guns, with Amagi just having less armor and more speed. But they're very much an exception that broadly proves the rule. Now, in terms of a design that starts with a battleship but trades out some of its weapons weight for speed while remaining about as well armoured as a battleship. Again, if we're looking at contemporary vessels in the Dreadnought era, it's not a thing. But in the pre-Dreadnought era, in some cases it kind of is. But that is in large part because the armour thickness on various battleships is wildly all over the place in the pre-Dreadnought period. And that means you can find examples of relatively poorly protected battleships and examples of armoured cruisers with more armour, at least in theory, in belt thickness, than said battleships. Although, again, you do have to investigate, one, especially in the pre-Dreadnought period, what kind of armour are they using? Are they using compound Harvey or Krupp steel? So what's their effective protection thickness? And also, again, what is the coverage of that belt armour? But at least in absolute terms, you can find some mid-1890s, late-1890s armoured cruisers that have better protection than some types of contemporary battleship, with slightly less firepower but greater speed. And very often these were the kinds of armored cruisers that were bought by the kinds of navies that thought that their armored cruisers might have to stand in the line of battle, either as a general component of it or at least a secondary component of it. Such as, say, the Imperial Japanese Navy, and to a certain extent even the Russian Navy. And that's before you get into the mess of the so-called second-class battleship, because the few purpose-built second-class battleships really straddle the line between battleship and armoured cruiser. And finally for this week, Dr. Feelgood asks, the US Army had a 37mm autocannon in service in both ground and air flavours, the M1 and the M4 respectively. Did the Navy ever consider adopting either of these guns for medium anti-aircraft defence in a fit of inter-service coordination? Yes, when they were looking for a replacement for the 1.1-inch gun, the Army 37mm gun, as seen here, was actually considered in the lineup for potential replacement in competition, but it reportedly lost out to both the British 40mm Pom-Pom and the 40mm Bofors for a wide variety of reasons, and the competition came down to the Bofors versus the Pom-Pom, and then, of course, the Bofors won. And yes, I'm still trying to find the exact records of those trials, because I found plenty of documentation around the outcome and a little bit describing the setup, but the documentation of the trials themselves is still proving very difficult to come by. But there you go. And that's it for this video. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening, if indeed you still are, and I hope you have a good day. But for now, see you in another video later.